Good afternoon. I'd like to call this committee to order. Representative Herron, who is the chair of the committee, is maybe a little bit later, so I'm going to conduct the meeting until he comes. I'm Representative Ledoux, and welcome to the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. Let the record reflect that it is 1:07 p.m. on Thursday, January 28th, and we are in room 120, and we have with us Representative Tuck, Representative Grunberg, Representative Hughes, and Representative Lynn. And before we begin, I'd appreciate it if everyone would turn off their cell phone, or they're going to be providing donuts at the next meeting. Today we will be hearing about the Governor's Alaska State Defense Force Rural Initiative. Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole will be briefing us, and Command Sergeant Major Richard Hildreth will be on standby to assist Commissioner Dole and to help answer any questions. So, would you like to put yourself on the record, Commissioner, and begin?
Good afternoon. I'm Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole of the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And I welcome this opportunity, Co-Chair Ledoux and members of the committee, to discuss what the Walker Mulotte Initiative to expand the Alaska Defense Force to make it more relevant to the homeland security needs of Alaska in areas that haven't been addressed previously. Moving to the second slide. What is the Alaska State Defense Force? For us, the Alaska State Defense Force is our second least well-known component of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. It is created by statute, and you can see the statute there that created it, 2605-100. It's referred to as part of what we call the organized militia, which would also include the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard and the Alaska Naval Militia, which the Naval Militia is our least well-known component in the state of Alaska. And it's interesting in looking as we go forward to this with this initiative, the language of this body previously with 2605-50 that specifically contemplated scout units in rural Alaska in western and northwestern and the Arctic regions. And we believe this is consistent with that legislative intent previously included. Now, also not included on this list is Alaska Statute 2605070. When the organization is or a part of it is placed into state active duty, that would be the enabling mechanism to provide a method for compensation or to utilize them. Moving to the
Representative Hughes.
Very foundational, Deputy Commissioner. Thank you for being here. I'm very interested in this because I've been learning about the Defense Force, as you know. And I think it would be helpful. It was one of the things that was helpful to me to understand why we even have one, why one was established as far as congressional authority. Can you talk a little bit about why the 50 states have, of those that choose to establish one, have done so?
Of the states that have chosen to have a state defense force, it's authorized by 32 United States Code Section 109. It for the Title 32 overall deals with the National Guard construct. Section 109 is a reservation clause that allows the states to maintain a state militia solely for state purposes. I'm going to go on to slide 3 because I think it frankly fits well into it. I think we're syncing on this, Representative Hughes. In that regard, the state defense force of our state, as well as the 15 state or so other states that have an active one at this point, exists to perform state missions and meet state needs that are beyond the ability of the regular state government and municipalities to meet the needs of, but is not subject to utilization or deployment or control of the federal government. It's kind of that gap filler where something happens that's greater than what the normal government structures and infrastructure in place of the different departments are ready to handle in a mass disaster, say, but it isn't a full-blown military entity. In doing that, it's always under state control, unlike the National Guard, which, as we all know, particularly of the last decade, is subject to deployment. It's also 100% state funded, at least is the backside of that. With the exception of California, that has a more robust, far more robust California military reserve than we have, they generally are not paid just for training like guardsmen are on their UDA periods or their annual training. They do receive state active duty compensation, however, for disaster response and for exercises to validate that training and make sure it's the right training for what needs to be done. And finally, they are minimally equipped. If you look at the logistics footprint of the incredible amount of equipment that we provide to the National Guard, State Defense Force receives minimal state equipment, and frequently the individuals supplement it with their own. These are by and large unpaid, tremendous patriots dedicated to Alaska and dedicated to our nation to be willing to take their own time and sacrifice to be there when they would be needed most and to prepare to do so.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you. And sorry, I missed it. So when not paid to train, that means they do training on their own time, or does that mean that we're not reimbursed by someone for their training?
They are not reimbursed. They do training. I wouldn't say training on their own time because they have set drill periods where they will come together for collective training. It will be a prescribed time that they will come for a block of instruction. On the road system, it's typically done on a weekend. With the logistics and time distance issues in rural Alaska, I could see that more likely turning into doing something quarterly where they would consolidate training to reduce the cost of coming together and the burden on the individuals.
Okay. Representative Ledoux?
People under the State Defense Force, are they covered under the Alaskan Code of Military Justice?
They will be under, if HB 126 is successful, they will be, and I think the folks on that side have a better influence on whether that will come to be or myself. I think it would be problematic right now to utilize that at all for them.
Okay. Representative Hughes, and then Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually peeked ahead of the next slide to make sure you weren't going to answer it then. I don't think it's there. I just wanted to... for you to comment, because I think it's tremendous that these patriots are volunteering in this way. And I want to take this opportunity to thank all those that have been serving quietly when a lot of us weren't even aware that they're doing it and on their own time and own dime doing the training you were just explaining. Could you just tell us a little bit about the typical Defense Force member, their background, their age, and where the ones that we currently have are located? I know you're going to be talking about the rural initiative, but just so we understand the baseline of what we have now.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there's a broad demographic there, so it's with some hesitation that I go in to attempt to depict the typical ASDF member. Obviously, we've talked about the dedication of these individuals and the willingness to step forward for their fellow Alaskans, which I think is the largest common denominator. If I look at the Alaska State Defense Force as a whole, and those who expressed interest currently joining in various places, generally it tends to be individuals who are more established in a career. Many are former, have served previously. They're more established in a career that, frankly, may be an economic discriminator, that they can afford to participate in the added cost of buying their own gear and the time away from earning. They come from an incredible variety of skill sets, from airline captains and surgeons to people who have worked in the who have run mining companies, that it's difficult to point to a common vocational background. I think the most intriguing group for me are the post 9/11 vets who are now just starting to join or express an interest in joining, who are using their education benefits, raising a family, and wanting to serve in this way. Many of these may have service-connected injuries that make it difficult for them to continue regular military service, such as in the National Guard, but this provides a means for them to continue to serve.
Yes, a follow-up?
Follow-up. And it is incredible that the wide birth of skill sets and the professionals that are involved. It's very impressive. You mentioned that some of them are prior service. Do you happen to know the percentage that were veterans? And I understand there's a lot of retired law enforcement folks in the ASDF, too.
through the chair. Representative Hughes, I've heard as high as 75%. Given the change, and the Alaska State Defense Force does not have the hard floor requirement of the Alaska Naval Militia for a certain percent to be involved, I'm not 100% certain of that 75% number as I sit here. The important thing, too, about the Alaska State Defense Force is it provides an opportunity to serve for those without a military affiliation. The person, because of the ruptured eardrum when they were a child, can't now get into the military, or others like that, or the person who is retired from the military but can now, or is older and didn't get in before they hit the age cutoff. So I've heard 75%, but one of the great strengths of ASDF is it can encompass a far broader group of Alaskans who want to help fellow Alaskans.
Thank you. I just want to again say, Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the sense of duty that the people have that have stepped forward to do that and in the future, too.
Yes. Following Representative Hughes' track there, so are they volunteer, recruited, nominated, or all of the above?
Generally, Representative Heron, they are we don't pay recruiters to go out and recruit. Generally, though, there is it tends to be right now through word of mouth. They will Alaska State Defense Force will appear have groups at public events to create awareness, and there's kind of through the web the starts of a recruiting campaign to amp up the presence. We envision invigorating that more.
Okay, for housekeeping, for the record, Representative Heron and Jim, Representative Culver have joined the meeting, and I appreciate the vice chair chairing while I was at another meeting. So we have in the queue is Representative Gruenberg and then Representative Lynn and then Representative Ledoux. So Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, thank you. First, Mr. Dole through the chair. When Representative Ledoux asked about the Alaska Code of Military Justice, realizing that hasn't yet passed, you said that there was some ambiguity or something. I forget the word you used. I didn't understand your answer.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the HB 26, as it is in its current form, will apply to the Alaska State Defense Force. What is now on the books, the older language that is being replaced, would not be effective or with the Alaska State Defense Force. What is under consideration in the House would be applicable.
So currently, nothing governs an offense committed by a state guardsman, militiaman, or woman, while they're on duty, presumably the federal law won't apply because they're not in the armed services. Will the state criminal code apply to somebody in that situation?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. As you noted, the state criminal law will continue to apply as it does now and would continue to apply as it does to guardsmen regardless of the ACMJ. So the state criminal, and for that matter, federal criminal law will continue to apply to both Alaska State National Guardsmen and members of the Alaska State Defense Force. At this time, there are some administrative remedies which are pretty minimal, as we discussed with HB 126 for guardsmen. There is a set of regulations under revision to deal with the Alaska State Defense Force. Generally, it comes down to you discharge or bar further participation is the only means to provide deterrence from unacceptable conduct.
I see. And some offenses, if I may continue, please.
Go ahead.
Some offenses in the, I'm going to call it the code, are uniquely military. So until that code is adopted, if somebody commits what would be an offense under that, like conduct unbecoming or failure to a disrespect for a superior officer, something like that, that would only go unpunished in the criminal sense, although you could take administrative action against the person, right?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Another area I'd like to ask. You said that people do not get pay for being in the state militia. Suppose you have a drill, and it's a once-in-a-year drill or something. You'll have people from all over the state coming to it, potentially. Are transportation costs covered and room and board?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, this goes back to the dialogue with Representative Hughes. Right now, it is paid out of the individual's pocket for that. That's that incredible volunteerism and spirit of service to fellow Alaskans you capture in the Alaska State Defense Force. Now, if we call them forward to an exercise or to an actual disaster, such costs are reimbursed. But for that training that happens once a year or it happens once a month, it is an individual borne expense.
If I may, Mr. Chair, please.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So you got somebody who lives out on the chain, and they've got to go to Bethel or someplace in the interior, who knows where, to get some training. They've got to pay their own plane fare?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that is correct, which is why we don't have people out in remote portions right now, either to participate in a locally dispersed location near them, which the governor's initiative would allow for, or to have that expense. Unless they're an airline pilot and they have ride-along privileges, it's cost prohibitive. And that's one of the other great disadvantages of having how centralized we are now at the Alaska State Defense Force. It makes it cost prohibitive to participate if you don't live relatively close.
So right now this is largely an urban deal, I gather, or for a few hubs, maybe Bethel or Nome or someplace. Am I right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you're correct. We have a presence in Juneau. We have a presence in Soldotna, in Valdez. We just started a small three-person signal detachment in Bethel. And, of course, we have Alcantara and Fairbanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Our colleague here has to leave for another meeting, so I'll ask Representative Hughes to do it, and then Representative Lynn, and then Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lynn, for letting me go before you here. I'll just...
Just don't ask my questions.
I just note, I learned that it's about $62 million that we get in federal funding for the National Guard. So, and right now we're currently funding, I believe, the State Defense Force. I think it is $30,000 that the state is. So, of course, it's only about 86 people. But that's just something to keep in the back of your mind. My question actually goes back to the code, and I know this isn't judiciary, but maybe you already answered and I missed it, but that code would only apply when they're called up on active duty. So if they're training on their own dime and their own time on a group exercise, that code doesn't apply? It's only when they're called up?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, our interpretation is it would also apply to them during training. One of the with the voluntary association with the Alaska State Defense Force comes the voluntary acceptance of personal jurisdiction under the Alaska Code of Military Justice.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe I may be corrected by the co-chair.
And can
yes,
I?
Representative.
And it is my understanding that it applies to National Guardsmen and Alaska State Defense Force members 24/7, whether they're on training exercises or they're not on training exercises. And we discussed this in the Judiciary Committee, and it was my understanding that that the volunteers of the Alaska State Defense Force wanted to be under the code and accepted the idea that there was a jurisdiction 24/7, 365 days a year.
Thank you. Representative Lynn, we're ready for those questions that nobody else asked.
Well, I got one answered by Representative Hughes, but I understand there's approximately 86 members.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that is correct.
Okay, and who's the youngest and who's the oldest? I assume there's probably 18 of them. The youngest, how old can somebody be and still be a member of it?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, at this moment there isn't an age that limits participation. on the how elderly someone is. I don't believe we would frankly have the statutory authority for someone less than 18 to serve in Alaska. And I don't think we need to go down the parental waiver route yet at this point. But I think on the older end, there isn't a cutoff at this point. So we have individuals serving.
I know I can't join because of my beard.
We'll negotiate.
You're negotiating that?
With the beard. I mean, if that's what it takes to get you to join. But
well, let me know.
Okay. But at this point, there's not an age cutoff.
So you're the oldest legislator? You'd be the oldest
That's right.
Member of the force.
Boot camp's going to be tough.
I'll be the. How many? Do you have any women in the group? Any men and women?
Well, now you want the girls, too.
I want, yes, of course.
Through the chair, Representative Len, we do have some women serving at this point. I don't have an exact number.
But you have some.
Yes.
Is it, what's the uniform? Could I tell a Defense Force member from the Guard or active duty?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, at this point, the uniform for the Special Troops Battalion that is based at the Alcantara Armory and elsewhere in Alaska is shifting.
Where is it again? I missed it.
The Alcantara Armory in Wasilla is where the main group is. However, we have those other detachments we talked about elsewhere in state. At this point, they're transitioning from the battle dress uniform, the old mostly green uniform that is no longer used by the Army, to allowing them to wear the Army, the ACU, or the Army combat uniform. For the rural Alaska piece, we don't envision it will be up to we're going to look to the Scout Battalion and frankly the desires of the senior leadership in terms of what's a more effective uniform for them. We frankly believe there's probably some more Alaska-specific garments that would be more effective in denoting their identity and all. On the current uniforms, the best way to spot an ASDF member is where on our uniforms while we're in the service it said U.S. Air Force. This just says Alaska. Yeah, so it doesn't say U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Marines, U.S. Navy. And that's the dead giveaway right there.
Approximately how many, quote, duty days? I know you don't call it duty days, but I mean, how often does a member typically serve in training or other kind of duty?
In the Alaska State Defense Force for training right now, the typical member will serve about 12 weekends or 24 days a year. In addition to that, will be the exercises or actual call-outs, and that is very dependent on the needs for the exercise or the actual disaster, and it's also dependent on funding, to be honest, on the exercise side.
And if I may dialogue just a little more, what's the typical training? Is it just marching, or is it doing a particular task, or what?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, it is... this group is operational. It doesn't have time for marching. When they're out there, it's either working on skills improvement, if it's first aid, or if it's route reconnaissance or position reporting or other drills necessary to what they do. We also have a fair number of specialists, such as engineers, doctors, communications folks, and those will be tied in how to present or how to produce those services in a disaster scenario.
And what kind of equipment do we provide? Equipment like vehicles, or construction equipment, or what equipment do we authorize?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, we provide a minimal amount of collective equipment. The individual equipment we try to provide a basic uniform kit to. The collective equipment, frankly, for the ASDF is kind of accumulated more than and been donated rather than been procured over its existence since 1984. As we move to the rural construct, we're not going to buy everyone a snow machine. However, there's some collective gear necessary to carry out their duties, such as communications gear, certain optical gear that we would envision buying and procuring for the entire organization, as well as mass disaster first aid kits and that sort of thing.
And then, just kind of delve in the other area because I don't know, any space A opportunities for Defense Force or the Guard for that matter?
Representative Lynn, through the chair.
You know what I mean by space A, right?
Yes. If I understand space A referring to the ability of a service member or retiree or family member to take advantage of a previously scheduled Air Guard or Air Guard, Army Guard, or active military flight and ride aboard it for free because it's an empty seat anyway. At this point, we don't have the authority to request that.
No space A on the guard doesn't have space A privilege?
The guard has limited space A privileges while in duty status.
Oh, in duty status.
Yes, but not just.
You mean if they're federalized?
Right. But or during a drill or during times such as annual training, Representative Lynn. However, the guard once you retire from the guard, then you gain the same space A privileges as a retiree from the active military.
We do, okay.
But not while in service.
I've used it from time to time. Thank you,
Representative Ledoux.
I just have a few questions. Workers' comp. So if somebody is injured while on duty and they're a volunteer. Are they entitled to workers' comp?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that's a poignant question for some other legislation we're pursuing with the administration. And the short answer is it depends. If they're on state active duty, participating in that exercise, responding to that disaster, in that case they will fall under the state workers' comp system as a state employee. Their rate of compensation will be driven by the state job series to which would determine their range for pay purposes. Now, that gets problematic for the person who is not in a paid training status, that person on that weekend training. Again, they're bearing that individual risk, and that's where the administration is exploring options right now and possibly making recommendations to the legislature.
A couple of follow-ups. So has anybody actually been injured during that training status that problem has actually come up and that person has not been covered?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we had a situation where an individual was not covered by workers' comp, and once you're not covered by workers' comp, there's then a tort liabilities that can attach. So the action was ultimately resolved. That was not too long ago in the last 10 years, but it was a significant issue in terms of the prior, just in the past, embracing the ASDF and allowing it to train for readiness. That's why that is an issue.
So the fellow might have actually been better off under the tort system than under workers' comp, but that's not necessarily the case for everyone who's been injured on the job.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think there's always that balance. There's tort cases and litigation. There's somewhat of a broader range of recovery. The workers' comp system gives you more certainty of recovery, but hopefully at a lower level. And I think that's the trade-off between the two.
So I've got two further
please,
questions.
Please go ahead.
So is there a presence in Anchorage?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there is a small presence in Anchorage it is tiny. Most members in Anchorage go out to Alcantara and Armory and Wasilla to do to drill. There is a couple, I think it's a couple, that do duties at Joint Force Headquarters on Fort Richards, on Jaber.
And are there any physical requirements in order to join the Defense Force?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, the physical requirements are we don't have the hundreds of pages of regulations of the National Guard or the federal military for participation. They must be able to demonstrate fitness for the duties they would be performing in the organization. We don't do a group PT test. You don't have to do a certain number of push-ups or sit-ups, but you must be able to demonstrate that you can perform the duties that you are physically do them.
Just one more follow-up. So there is no actual boot camp type of a situation?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. The boot camp, we're not going to use that to stop Representative Lynn from joining us. However, we do have non-commissioned officer development courses and officer candidate school and other professional development courses. They are not as physical as the federal military equivalents.
Thank you.
On that point, I've had a couple of tough boot camps in the past, a long time ago, with Caesar. You know.
With Caesar. Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I can't top that one. To follow up on Representative Ledoux's questioning, As you know, I was very concerned about one section that did not find its way into the bill that passed out last week, dealing with the ability to sue in National Guard situations. When that legislation was enacted in 2003, and Representative Lynn and I have talked a bit about this, it was part of a larger bill that had four parts, as I recall, not like Gaul, which was only divided into three parts. This had four parts. And my memory is that one other part of that bill in the Murkowski administration dealt with workers' comp. When you're talking about looking at this, are you talking about dealing with that second part of the bill that was enacted in 2003 or something different?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this initiative does not address the changes in tort and workers' comp law from 2003. What that law did in 2003 was it clarified the applicability of workers' comp to when that remedy was available vis-a-vis Guard service, and to clarify, it was not a remedy if you were serving under Title 32 United States Code at the time of a injury. That arose as a result of the Hemsel case and the C-12 crash down here by Juneau, where a concern of the Supreme Court was that workers' comp had not been offered to the aircrew or to the aircrew that was involved in that, even though they received federal Employment Compensation Act benefits because they were paid as a Title 32 technician.
Just for the record, I am most interested in pursuing that whole area, and we, for political purposes, dropped it last week, but my interest remains, and I would like if your staff could work with me or brief me and anybody else who might be interested or have a stray staff that has nothing to do and would be interested. This is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. One more question?
Yeah, one more. Do you have any firearms training, access to firearms, or anything, personal self-defense or anything like that, any occasion?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, you were asking if the Alaska State Defense Force would have that. The Alaska State Defense Force, as you probably know, was disarmed under the prior administration. That is, up until about 2000, maybe 2010, they would provide their own weapons. They would go to the range together to demonstrate marksmanship skills. The prior administration made a determination that they...
By that, you mean the Parnell administration?
Yes.
Was there a cause for that? I mean, did somebody, the governor just thought of it, or what?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I believe, and there is some connecting the dots in my mind on this, an outside investigation was done by a National Guard member from another state that was critical of some of the standardization and policies on how firearms training and qualifications were being handled at that point. Through DMVA, the prior administration determined they would no longer have armed missions or training.
I would appreciate it. Let me know at your leisure, about that. I remember when I first got elected, I came down on the ferry, actually rode the ferry. That was 2003, I guess it was, not that long after 9/11. And I got off the ferry boat, and there were sentries. Actually, I think someone told me they were Defense Force, but I'm not sure.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, after 9/11, the Alaska State Defense Force did step up to secure key infrastructure points along the bridge, and that may very well have been some of them. The Coast Guard also has a presence that has on occasion.
Because I could, God forbid, see some need for that again. Let me know at your leisure.
Okay. You have a few slides left to go. Why don't you go through the slides, and then we'll have another flurry of questions at the end. Please.
Moving on to slide four, what we envision this Alaska, State Defense Force Scout Battalion to do are missions vital to homeland security that will also make them more capable and able to support anywhere in Alaska in the event of a mass disaster. Route reconnaissance is how you figure out how to get through a disaster zone to provide services or assistance. Zone reconnaissance is how you do a widespread area assessment to determine what needs to be done. Disaster response support and incident command system training enables you to integrate seamlessly with the other state and federal agencies that will be there to assist. Damage assessment assures that there's standard and consistent reporting so that the government can properly other agencies can figure out where the resources are needed. Movement and replenishment is challenging in a good day. And what we need are folks that can work on a compromised or non-existent infrastructure to be able to operate a sled or a four-wheeler with a heavy load behind it and get it where it needs to be brought. Medical station support, we know, the medical service level would be a challenge in any but the smallest disaster in Alaska. To the extent we can not provide doctors but provide trained staff ready to integrate and set up the smaller aid stations or supplement the larger ones, it assists. Again, looking at community disaster pre-mitigation support, taking advantage of these volunteers in the dispersed communities to identify the vulnerabilities now and figure out what needs to be put in place or what hazards will occur in a disaster can save lives later on in the event of an actual disaster. And again, on the mission task list, the Arctic Operations Survival and Movement Training, to have a competent force that knows how to operate in Alaska is necessary for both our nation and state. I think the value added to Alaska, looking at slide five, is obvious. For those that were in South Central Alaska Sunday morning, they got woke up with a jolt. Actually, it was about 30 seconds of jolts. And the challenge we have is 80% of our reserve force structure, the Guard and ASDF, is in South Central Alaska. One big earthquake and all our eggs are in one basket and have to deal with their own families rather than be available to assist. If you think of the Good Friday earthquake, those guardsmen you saw helping out all over South Central Alaska, they were primarily not from Anchorage. They were from rural Alaska who came in to assist. And this is what the Alaska State Defense Force can bring back to us. Again, I think these other enhanced resilience we talked about, domain awareness goes to the homeland security issue, and that is to find out what is actually going on in rural Alaska in areas. As we look at the Arctic commerce increasing, 2,000 vessels a year transiting our shores with minimal awareness of who or what is going ashore from those, this provides a means to track what is going on through there. Looking down just the others, I think are speak for themselves of what they will gain from this mission task list. This is what the organization would look like, looking at slide six. The military loves wiring diagrams, and sometimes we just can't stop ourselves. The short version is it would be comparable to the Alaska National Guard Scout Battalions that were previously in rural Alaska. It would have a battalion staff to assure the different functional areas were handled. As envisioned right now, we would start with an initial build of a headquarters in Bethel and then a company dispersed nearby. And you can see with Bravo, with the two companies on the right, Bravo Company and Charlie Company, we would hope to grow that elsewhere to take care of the needs. Not everything, not focused as Bethel is the only rural location, but expand out from there. And these companies, too, would be dispersed as well. So you would not see just these little clumps, but rather small, probably 4 to 15-person entities, depending on village size. Slide 7 kind of shows what that would look like graphically as we look there. The key is a distributed force to either come together to assist in time of need or to be dispersed out there as eyes and ears and to enhance overall state resiliency.
So, Commissioner, is the advantage of having a readiness center in Bethel is also part of it?
Well, in your case, Representative, Mr. Chair, that's correct. The readiness center there, in order to minimize our cost on this, we can use National Guard facilities as long as we do not incur extra cost and we do not interfere with the mission. The readiness center is where we would envision the battalion headquarters being housed in that regard. It is a key advantage as a very capable venue, and also I think is that the transportation to hub is very conducive for the initial build out.
Well, in the past, the committee has been able to enjoy the assets of the National Guard there when there was tours. So maybe it's appropriate. Maybe there'll be a mission that this committee could observe, and so they, my colleagues here, could see the distinct advantages that the region has related to the Guard and for this the possible ASDF rollout.
Chairman Herron, we'll communicate with your staff the dates and opportunities as those come up for both ASDF and the National Guard to make sure those we can do what we can.
Okay, we'll hold off on questions until he finishes.
I just have one very, if I may.
Yes.
What's HHC mean?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, HHC is Headquarters and Headquarters Company. It's an Army speak for the headquarters, what we all think of as the entity that oversees all of them. The Headquarters Company is where the staff and other support elements would be for that.
I see. Thank you.
What would be the Navy equivalent then?
Wasn't my ship.
Okay, please proceed, and then we'll go to questions.
We're down to the conclusion. Alaska has a long and proud tradition of a dispersed group of volunteers serving the entire state and, frankly, meeting those homeland security needs of those eyes and ears, but also being there for disaster response and pre-mitigation, what we'd say preparing beforehand. Mm-hmm. We see this as the next way to go forward in that. We are continuing to press and find ways to increase Alaska National Guard participation in rural Alaska. However, there's a gap that we need to fill now, and we would submit that this Alaska State Defense Force proposal proposed by the Walker-Mulott administration is the way to meet that gap.
So great. I would like to tell a great ATG story is when I had the opportunity to go to St. Lawrence Island, and I was in Gamble. This very an elder, he was probably 90s, he came right up to me and says, "Where are you from?" And I told him, Bethel. And he says, "Well, I know a guy from Bethel." And I says, "Yeah, you do?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, Eddie Hoffman." And I was Chief Eddie Hoffman, and he was in the ATG. And during the war, he was sent to St. Lawrence. Eddie grew up 170 miles upriver. He was born in Nepaimute, and their mode of transportation was, of course, dog teams. They didn't have, that was long before snow machines, etc. And so they took his skill set and sent him to St. Lawrence, and that's how St. Lawrence was patrolled, was by dog team. And it was just remarkable that they would bring a musher from the middle Kuskokwim to defend St. Lawrence. So, Bob, later in the day, you're going to go in front of the subcommittee, Military and Veterans Affairs. And so is the initiative request in that budget?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. It is consists of two parts. The $1.3 million is a change record request, which is what would fund the operations side of building the new Alaska State Defense Force entity. And build in terms of establishing and getting the processes and the first exercising of it to validate it. The logistics tailor equipment and supply procurement is a separate capital item, capital budget item of $1
million. So, Commissioner, is everybody's in a different reality right now, so I know you've made the request, but it's going to be a heavy lift. What would be the minimum?
Mr. Chairman, we had not actually thought through that question. We will, whatever amount is allocated for this personal change record, we will build out as much as we can with it. It's a matter of scale and what we can afford, and just we hadn't done a minimum build. We had looked at what it would take to launch this and to provide the springboard for expansion into Nome and Kotze in the future. I'm not prepared to give you a minimum as I sit here today. We will whatever is appropriated to this, we will use to start establishing that capability. we can't foresee when the need will be, so we have to utilize whatever we can.
Okay. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, Mr. Chairman. It's been a while since I've been in committee.
Do I have that vote in the future?
You go to our caucus now?
Yeah, I'm not used to making those type of decisions. Decisions are already made. When we look at, like Cordova, for example, the overloads and snow and everything else, was there a deployment with the Alaska State Defense Force, or was that strictly the reserves on the, or the National Guard on that one?
So the Chair, Representative Tuck, for the Cordova deployment, it was the Alaska National Guard in state active duty. We could not use federal Title 32 funds to pay them for that mission. Just a footnote, when you pay the National Guard in state active duty, it appears to come out higher than when you pay the State Defense Force to do the same job in state active duty, because the how the state pay ranges come out is lower than the military pay rates. But that was guardsmen in state active duty.
And if I may, Mr. Chair. So what's the – how are decisions made – when the Alaska State Defense Force is deployed on an emergency versus the National Guard?
Under Alaska Statute 2605-70, when the governor determines he is going to mobilize a portion of the organized militia, first he will get a recommendation that will come from the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management as to what the specific mission or need is for them to do. If they need helicopter firefighting like we did last summer, well, there's no helicopters in ASDF, they're not going to do it. We will then look at the need and determine what the most appropriate resource is to that can best meet that mission.
Question, Representative Ledoux.
So I think part of it's already been answered. These four state active duty positions. My understanding is we don't have those now.
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, that's correct. If this is funded, this would be the backbone, using state active duty funding, not creating PCNs or creating positions with tenure, but rather as funding is available to implement this, to make sure that we had good accountability and internal controls for the use of funds, for the distribution of equipment, and for making sure the design and participation in the exercises was appropriate to the mission.
So you're not asking for money in the budget to fund these positions now?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, we included it in this proposal together. We felt was as a means to drive that need. In terms of, this is where the incredible area of mission development needs to happen in Western Alaska, where we don't have a means to prosecute those missions with the existing ASDF infrastructure.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Sergeant Major, did you have a presentation or testimony? Okay. Says you do, and so you're welcome to say anything. Okay, well, if there's no other questions, I appreciate this. I sit on the subcommittee. I'll be there with to listen intently, and it's not because I live in Bethel. I think it's a good initiative, and albeit with a fiscal reality, it may be a slow rollout. So, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, it's 1:55, and we're adjourned, and we will let the committee know when we can meet again. Thanks.